This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 9 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have Anish Shroff joining us. Anish, who is the voice of the Carolina Panthers and one of ESPN's most versatile play-by-play announcers. Anish, thanks so much for making some time to come on the podcast today.
I appreciate the invite, and thank you for giving me a couple of minutes to stall to get a five-year-old out of the room who was making fart noises for the last 20 minutes.
Of course, yeah. No worries there. I want to get this out of the way. You're the voice of the Carolina Panthers. You call college football games, college basketball. You might be ESPN's foremost voice in lacrosse, but where does being the face of the Duke's Mayo Bowl rank in your career accomplishments?
Well, you know, it's only been 2 years now. If we can get it for a third year in a row, and that's not my call,
yeah.
But if they put me on it for a third year in a row, I think we can start to have that conversation. But I got to be honest, the first year that we did that bowl, I don't think I've had more fun broadcasting an event. And tangentially, that in some ways helped me get the Panthers job, because that game was played in Charlotte at right. Bank of America Stadium, home of the Panthers. That was probably the most fun I've ever had calling a game.
I'll stick with the Mayo questions. I want to get those out of the way early because I loathe mayonnaise, but
I've got plenty. I have so much mayonnaise in my pantry. If you need some and you're willing to give Dukes a try, I'm not trying to be a salesman here or anything, but their mayo is pretty good.
No, part of me hopes that you will say that you were using vanilla pudding on the broadcast and not mayonnaise, like, secretly. But what was your reaction when you were told you were going to call the Duke's Mayo Bowl? And what was your reaction when you were told that it would include eating foods covered in mayo during the broadcast?
So there's a story behind that. That season, our crew for college football, it was myself, Mike Golic Jr., and Taylor McGregor. And we had sort of done some, you know, wacky, offbeat, off-kilter stuff. It was three people who liked to have fun, who understood this is sports. We're not curing cancer. We can lighten the mood sometimes. Not everything has to be so serious. And Mike had this fascination throughout the year with just terrible food. Week one, week two, we were in Mississippi, maybe week two, week three, I don't remember where, but we had a game at Mississippi State. The next week we were at Ole Miss or vice versa. And again, you know, Mike Golic, we know who his dad was, Golic Jr. The guy didn't grow up, you know, where's my next meal coming from, right? Yet this guy eats like Oliver Twist. You put food in front of him and it just vanishes in seconds. So we're at this place called Big Bad Breakfast in Starkville, Mississippi. And that was the first time I ate with him. And he orders this giant plate of all sorts of food. And I look over, we had just sat down and it's just, I'm going, dude, what? Like, no one's taking your food. Are you okay? The following week, he's searching around for chicken on a stick, but a specific kind, gas station chicken on a stick. And so his food sense became this running theme behind the scenes throughout the season. Everywhere we would go, this guy had a sixth sense for finding an ice cream place or a donut shop. One day in Tallahassee, we walked 25 minutes through who knows what neighborhood and where at what time of night to find this ice cream place that he was gung-ho about. So when we got this assignment, we were through the moon. And our producer gets COVID about 3 or 4 days before the actual game. So Paul Irvin, who had done college football but had been working on the NBA, drops in to produce the game. And he says, listen, I have not done a college football game all season long. I am open to whatever you guys want to do. And when you say that to our crew, we kind of felt like hyenas circling a zebra. It was, oh yeah, you want to go full sicko? We want to go full sicko. So we started throwing out these, you know, crazy wild ideas. And one of the ideas that we had thrown out was, yeah, maybe we could dip some random food in mayonnaise every quarter, just as a gag. It's a game between 2 6-6 teams, right? The whole crux of the game, the reason people are watching is because of what's going to happen at the end. The coach is going to get doused with mayonnaise. So what happened was, in the lead up to the game, we found out that the actual mayo dump would not happen on live television. It would only happen on the app. And we were kind of bummed, because our whole thing was, hey, we want to keep people around for the end game, you know, promote this. Well, right. Now we need to find a way to keep people watching and build up to this moment, which is going to be on the app. So Golic says, all right, you had the idea for dumping certain foods in mayonnaise. I get to pick the food. So I had no idea what the food was going to be. Before the game, we're down on the field, and he's got one of those, whatever, 36 packs of Oreos, you know, the big, you know, 1 foot long,
yeah,
6 inch long Oreo packs. And he's cradling it like a football. And I say to him, what's with that? He goes, oh, you just wait. You know the rest.
That is good, because, like, as somebody who was writing about sports media at the time when that was going on, like, I had it on my radar that day that they were going to be dumping the mayo on the winning coach's head. And, like, that was something I had to look out for. Then I found out that it was happening not on live television, but then all of a sudden on social media, I see video and clips of you guys dunking stuff in mayonnaise. I think peanut butter and jelly might have been one of the first ones.
Yes.
So now I quickly had to tune to the game. Like, now I have to watch what else you guys are going to do in case there's any clips that I need to get. So it absolutely went from me just trying to remember to pay attention to what happens at the end of the game to now tuning into the entire game to follow it. So, I mean, it's absolutely disgusting, but it's an amazing marketing campaign by Dukes. Like, credit them for that. And it was a great job by you guys to bring so much attention to the broadcast. Has your mayo intake increased off camera since broadcasting those games?
It has, believe it or not, it has, because we have so much in the pantry. Hey, we need a condiment. Well, I've got a bunch of Duke's mayo, so let's use the Duke's mayo. But I think the bigger thing for us, it was, how do you differentiate a bowl game these days? There are so many. And again, it was a 6-6 UNC team, a 6-6 South Carolina team. Not taking anything away. You have Sam Howell playing his last game for UNC. Shane Beamer getting South Carolina into the postseason. I think they were picked to finish near the bottom of the SEC that year. So you had some good stories. But you had two coaches who leaned into it as well. Shane was great about it. Mack Brown was great about it. So from our standpoint, we just felt all anybody is talking about in relation to this bowl game is a coach getting dumped with mayonnaise.
Yeah.
Let's not just shoulder into it. Let's just lean into it. Let's cannonball into this thing. And that's kind of how that thing started. And it's become, depending on how you feel about mayonnaise, it's become magical or it's become a monster.
It seemed like you were struggling with the Oreo dipped in mayo the first year. And then somehow you rallied to declare that the aftertaste was not that bad. Was that an honest comment?
100% honest. So I put it in my mouth, because part of your brain at that point is going, Oreos and mayonnaise, you know, this is a double X. This is a three strikes, you're out. We can't be doing this. And I took a bite, and, you know, the synapses, the neurons in the brain initially were resisting. Like, I can't let you like this. And then I took a bite. I thought I was going to gag. That is true. And then they cut off camera. And then as I'm chewing it, it actually had a little bit of twang on the back end, and it went down okay, to the point where this past year I dumped a macaroon in mayonnaise, actually dumped multiple macaroons or macarons. What do they call it?
Macarons.
Macarons. Yes.
Right. Macaroon is like the coconut cookie. Macaron is that the French cookie.
Yes. Pardon my French. So the macarons. So I'm dumping this, and I probably ate about two or three off camera. Then, you know, tape myself eating one of them, and then people went nuts with that. How could you soil such a great dessert? Whatever.
And then Golic leaves ESPN last year. So then you had Brock Osweiler stepping in, and you kind of took the lead in the mayo, dipping things in mayo. How was Brock with that? Like, was he aware when he signed on to be the analyst? Was he aware that was something that was going to happen, or was he shocked by it?
I love Brock. I don't think he was as keen into doing the full mayonnaise dance that Golic was. And Golic had been texting me, you know, for weeks leading into that game. Hey, man, I'm not there. Make me proud, brother. Make me proud. So I felt like I had to carry the burden of Mike's spirit, Mike's ghost, and had to go double sicko. Brock was a really good sport about it. You know, deviled eggs and mayonnaise. But he had a line. He had a line in the sand. Mike did not have that line in the sand. And again, in Brock's defense, what we're asking him to do, this is full sicko stuff.
We'll talk about some stuff that's a little less nauseating and get into some other aspects of your career. I'm curious about, you were a contestant on ESPN's Dream Job.
Yeah, early on. Going back,
Was that during or after college?
Right after college. I had just graduated.
And how was that experience? Did it lead to other opportunities? Did it help you to land at ESPN later on in your career? Like, did it build some sort of, were you able to build some connections through that?
I think it helped. It definitely helped. It led me to Al Jaffe. It got me in front of Al Jaffe, who was at the time the head of talent there. And you know, he made it clear to me then that I had made an impression on him, even though I didn't win. There was a part of me, and I can say this now, I'm not sure I wanted to win. And what I mean by that is, it would be hubris to say at 22, I was ready for that. But there were things that happened during the course of the show where you get a sense of, I think I know what they're looking for. I think I know what to expect. It is a TV show, and a lot of it is a simulation, and it unfolded like a TV show. They're playing up storylines and drama and all that stuff. I looked at the big picture, zoom out, macro. If I win this thing, would this help my career 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now? And we all know first impressions can be lasting impressions. And you go to ESPN at 22, you're not ready. That opportunity to get there again, if you're not renewed or not kept, may not come again because you've already cast your impression on those folks. So having gone to Syracuse and you hear about paying your dues and all that stuff, yeah, it felt a little like, am I doing that? And so I had some, you know, freelance opportunities afterwards. I had some opportunities that in the short term made sense. I decided to kind of think long term and ended up applying for and getting a job in Yakima, Washington. After that, Market 126, I was essentially a one-man sports department in a split market, did everything from, you know, anchoring, reporting, live shots, producing, writing, logging footage, editing. And I probably owe Yakima more than I can ever repay. Wasn't the greatest place to live. I felt homesick coming in from the East Coast, but that gave me, I think, a foundation. It helped me find my voice. It probably accelerated my growth as a broadcaster. So, going back to ESPN later, having that connection, having known Al Jaffe, and when I had sent him a tape at my next job, I just said, hey, I'd love to just get some feedback on my work. And he said, I remember seeing your last tape. Send me your next sportscast. We might have some openings. And you know, that's kind of how ESPN happened.
Being that Dream Job was a TV show first, did it feel when you were on it like an honest judge of talent?
I think there were certain aspects of it where, you know, the things that at the time were valued, like writing and delivery and reading highlights and sports knowledge, things like that, you know, you can't fake that stuff. You don't have a writer. You don't have somebody doing that stuff for you. But you know, we're not doing an hour show. I remember when I started at ESPN News, all of a sudden my first week, I'm doing 3 hour shows on ESPN News 4 or 5 days a week. I probably logged more airtime than I had in my previous 6 months at my last job in Syracuse, where I'm doing 2-3 minutes a night. So I think from that standpoint, it's hard to simulate the real thing, but it's a very, very abridged Cliff Notes version of some of what you would get if you were to be at ESPN.
was the goal play-by-play at that point, or was it to be an anchor?
You know, it's funny. It was play-by-play out of college. It was play-by-play, play-by-play, and then dream job happened. And I have never been somebody who – this is going to sound weird – who marks endpoints and says, I have to do this at this age. I've got to get here. I've got to get here. I've always been a – hey, this is a pretty cool detour. I'm going to follow that road and see where it leads, because I like the trees and I like the foliage. And sometimes the detour becomes the destination. So dream job happened and it took me on the studio anchoring path. And all of a sudden I was able to fast track a little bit, and it got me to ESPN, what, 3-4 years later. So I said, all right, we'll try this. And then the opportunity to do play-by-play came up at ESPN. And that's where I got the itch again. Oh, I remember now how much I like this. And then I started bothering some of their people. What can I do to get more opportunities?
You're one of ESPN's faces of college lacrosse. And you're also one of the lead voices for the Premier Lacrosse League. Did you play lacrosse? Have you always liked lacrosse? Like, or was that more of just an opportunity to call games that you kind of like jumped at that when it was presented?
So I never played lacrosse, which I can tell you certainly does bother a segment of the lacrosse audience. they want to know why. And I mean, the real answer was, you know, my high school didn't have it. And if I wanted to go outside of my high school and play it, we didn't have the money to do so. It was pretty logical. I went to Syracuse. I was a scholarship kid. And when I got to Syracuse, the college radio station there, WAER, they would say, you have an opportunity here to call college football, men's basketball, home and away. And if you want to do that, learn lacrosse, because they always did every men's lacrosse game as well. So I would go to high school games and learn the sport and basically have a Lacrosse for Dummies book before it was called Lacrosse for Dummies. Learned the game, picked up some nuances. And when I was at Syracuse over my 4 years, they had a player by the name of Mike Powell, who's considered one of the 3 or 4 greatest college players of all time. This guy was, you know, basically Pete Maravich, Wayne Gretzky with a lacrosse stick. So I got to watch a transcendent player, which, again, for 4 years, that makes you a fan of the sport. And so I left Syracuse being a fan of the sport, even though I got there knowing nothing about it, and I would follow it. So when I got to ESPN, there was an opportunity to do a lacrosse game. John Vassallo, who's the coordinating producer down in Charlotte, I'm down there for signing day. We're talking in a hallway, and he's like, yeah, I do the event stuff down here. Have you done games? I said, yeah, sure, baseball, basketball, football. I've done some lacrosse. And he goes, oh, you've done some lacrosse, have you? I might need a guy, you know, for lacrosse. So I said, yeah, if somebody calls in sick, consider my hand up. And he said, well, would you want to do a game? I don't mind throwing you a game, see how you do. And I said, yeah. So I remember going to Washington, D.C. for Notre Dame, Georgetown. Probably had a month to prepare. So I knew everybody's grandmother at the time. This was 2010. Did the one game, really liked it, really enjoyed just play-by-play. Getting back out there, being in the field. And then that led to some football that fall. And then that led to some more lacrosse, and they steadily grew my role on the lacrosse front. But yeah, I did have, you know, at the time, probably a 10-15 year history with the sport in terms of following it. And that made, again, the transition to doing it on a regular basis pretty seamless. So yes, if you're asking, did I grow up with the sport? No, I did not. Had no exposure to the sport until I got to college. Fell in love with it, watching it and covering it in college. And obviously it stayed that way.
When you started calling games in college, did you, without knowing much about the sport at first, did you find that the cadence of calling a lacrosse game mirrored that of any other sport?
No, because I had no reference point. I had no reference point for lacrosse. And in college, you're not even thinking about that. But now when I look back, I almost feel there was some value in not knowing.
Okay.
Where I could almost craft my own call.
Yeah.
You don't know what the template is to call this sport. So when I started doing it, there were just things that this feels right. I'm going to go with it. And it's that, what do you call it? Like the beginner's spark, right? Let me just see how I'm going to do it. I want to write a screenplay. Something I dabble with in my spare time. I found it was easier to write before I bought one of those how to write a screenplay books. Yeah. That helps you with the formatting, but in terms of thoughtfulness, stream of consciousness, sometimes it's easier just to go do it.
Yeah.
And then go back. And so that's kind of how lacrosse happened.
So did you, or I'll ask, could you have foreseen when you started calling lacrosse that you would continue to call lacrosse games decades later and like, Now you're the voice of the Carolina Panthers and you're still calling lacrosse. Would that have been something that would have been a shock with, when you were in college and were told that would happen?
No. No. That sport has done a lot for my career. It's been a gateway drug in a lot of ways, leading me to other opportunities. But no way yeah. I could have imagined that.
Do you expect or want to continue calling lacrosse games now for the foreseeable future?
I would love to. You know, it's not my call at the end of the day, yeah. but I would love to.
We spoke to Ryan Rucco on the podcast about a month or two ago, and he had mentioned that when he got the opportunity to start calling WNBA games, he received the advice of don't discount the importance of calling a big game. And like, does that kind of resonate with you and lacrosse at all, just that even though lacrosse might not have the national following that basketball or football does, when it's a playoff or a Final Four or a championship is on the line, there's still that big game feel?
Yeah, and I think it's on us to make it feel big. We cover and call lacrosse differently. You're not selling the sport of basketball. You're not selling the sport of football or baseball to your audience when right. you're calling those games. With lacrosse, there is this effort on our part, too, to grow the game.
Right.
I, again, had no exposure to the sport, fell in love with it. So I always go back to that. So who else out there like me who's watching this for the first time, how do I make them fall in love with the sport?
Yeah.
What are the little things I have to explain? We'll have the diehards, and they're loud, and it's a vocal minority, and they get annoyed when we explain, when you shoot the ball out of bounds, possession is awarded to the player on the team that is closest to the ball when it goes out of bounds. Oh, we know that. Why do you keep explaining it? When championship weekend is on and the playoffs are on and the big games are on and we bring in new viewers and my friends are watching just because I'm doing the game, I get a dozen texts. Hey, how come when they shoot it out of bounds, the team that shot it gets to keep the ball? That's the first question people have when they don't know the sport. So I always think of it in that terms. Yes, we're not going to dumb it down completely, but we want to make it inclusive. We want to grow this thing. The game has grown geographically. It's got significant work to do to grow demographically. It's got to look like the rest of America if it's really going to push into the mainstream. But there's probably more positive momentum for the sport now than at any point, at least in the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah, for sure. How was your first year as the Carolina Panthers radio voice? Obviously, as like we just discussed, you've called big games before in various sports. You've been in front of big crowds and spoken to large audiences, but did the NFL feel different?
Yeah, it was something that I always wanted to do. I grew up on pro sports, so I found a really great niche at ESPN with college sports, but I grew up on pro sports. And I've loved football. I love calling football. And, you know, there haven't been opportunities to do NFL on radio at ESPN. There haven't been a ton of opportunities to do NFL elsewhere. But the year before, I got a chance to do a preseason game for the Broncos. I was filling in for Steve Levy. Steve had reached out to me and said, hey, I'm doing a Monday Night Football game for ESPN during the preseason. Would you be interested in potentially jumping in for me? He helped get my name out there with the Broncos folks. They hired me. And I remember walking away going, man, this would be so cool, whether it's preseason, if I could just get a little bit of a taste here with the NFL. And then shortly after, I find out Mick Mixon, the longtime Panthers broadcaster, is retiring. So I put my name in the hat, go through the process. They end up hiring me. And yeah, it was neat. I don't think I felt goosebumps before a broadcast in years. and I felt the goosebumps and the butterflies before the first regular season game. And it was kind of neat. It was like, wow, it's cool to feel nervous again. You're doing something new and different. And it wasn't a bad nervousness. It was a good nervousness. But that challenge really, I think, sparked me a little bit. It was so cool to do something new. It was a new challenge. There is an art form to radio that I've always loved. I didn't have cable growing up, so I listened to a ton of radio as a kid, whether it was the Mets on the radio, whether it was Sterling and Kay doing the Yankees on the radio, Ian Eagle with the Jets, Bob Papa with the Giants. I listened to so much radio, and so it was nice to go back to the roots of radio, which is what I did in college, and you can paint with that fine brushstroke. So I loved it. I absolutely loved it. The season was about seven different odysseys in one, but a team that started 1-5 was playing for a playoff spot in week 17. It was wild. People at the Panthers were telling me, you probably saw four or five seasons wrapped up in one season in 2022.
Yeah, that the I like that radio versus kind of television comparison, radio being different. Do you need to keep like a bigger arsenal of adjectives when you're calling a radio game?
So it's funny. I try to lose adjectives. For me, radio is action verbs. And this is an old Ezra Pound adage. Ezra Pound used to have a saying that adjectives were useless if you have the right verb. So if you have the right verb, you don't need the adjective. And that was always the fun part of it. When you go into the boiler room, how many different ways am I going to say a guy twists across midfield? Does he turbine across midfield or pretzel across midfield or pinwheels or whirligigs, whatever the word you want to use. And then it lets you have fun with language, right? Using nouns as verbs to describe something. He Amtraks a defender, however you want to say it. But I've always enjoyed that. And so when I'm reading and or I'm watching and you hear something, I always make a little note. I used to have a book. Now I do it on the notepad app on the iPhone, just to kind of make a note of it. And then you're thinking, where could I potentially use that? So with radio, you're just more wary of those things. But I love it. I love the language component of radio.
How's the travel calling college football on Saturday and the NFL on Sunday?
Well, yeah, if my ESPN bosses are watching or listening, I made it to every game, so that's good. I learned very quickly, don't complain. I think it's the anxiety of travel, especially early in the season. Going into the 2022 season, coming off the summer, I had a brutal travel schedule that summer in terms of cancellations, delays. And I remember the first overlap weekend, it was college football at College Station. So we had the App State Texas A&M game. And then the following day, I'm back in Charlotte, home opener against Cleveland, 1 o'clock game. So I'm not flying out till Sunday morning. And there was a part of me that worried, my flight gets delayed or canceled and it's the first game, this becomes a news story.
Yeah.
If I'm not there on time, it looks bad for me. It looks bad for the Panthers. It looks bad for ESPN. So you're worried about that. And then there were a couple of times, I think the following 2 weeks, I had a 7 p.m. Saturday game and a 1 o'clock Sunday game. So I've learned you figure it out. You know, there was an executive at ESPN who told me very candidly, and you know, I don't mean for this to come off in a bad way, but he said, hey, nobody told you to take that job. And so it's on you to figure that out. And so I took that to heart and I said, yeah, you're right. Nobody told me, and something I wanted to do. So I took that to heart and I made it work. And so what I would try to do is I would make sure I would fly I would get to an airport that gave me multiple options if I was flying out on Sunday. And that's all the Panthers asked for. Make sure you have multiple options and knock on wood, no incidents in season one.
What was the longest, the farthest that you had to travel from a Saturday to a Sunday game?
We were in Bloomington, Indiana on Saturday, drove to Chicago after the game, stayed in an airport hotel and took the first flight out to LA for a Rams game the next day. That was probably the longest one. We had a football game at Arizona State on a Saturday and we're playing the Ravens on Sunday at 1 o'clock back in Baltimore. But luckily, that game ended on Saturday in time where I could get on a red eye Saturday night, and I got to the hotel, you know, late Saturday night, early Sunday morning, around like 12:30-ish. So it wasn't really that bad. But yeah, the LA one, flying out to LA morning of the game, a lot of coffee before that one.
Are you able to make all the pregame meetings with coaches and players and things like that for both?
Yeah, so a lot of that stuff is already in the can. We'll do our pregame interview with coach during the week. We have our coaches show on Monday. I'll try to go to practice once or twice a week during the course of the season. So most of that stuff is taken care of. And we've got a great support team. David Langton, who's our executive producer on radio, is tremendous. Bill Voth, who's our director of broadcasting, who just left, tremendous. The Panthers were incredible in supporting me in recognizing that I had the ESPN responsibilities, and also was beholden to them too.
How is, like, what about, even obviously the travel is difficult in itself, but what about just even the preparation of having to prepare for two football games in one weekend?
Yeah, I had to figure out a formula for that. And so preparation for the college game obviously is much harder. It's TV. It's more why and how. It's more contextual. So you're finding stories and you're finding stats and nuggets to support what you want to say. And a lot of times you will have Indiana, Maryland one day, and then you've got Iowa against Michigan State, and then it's Tulane and Memphis, right? There's not one conference. You're bouncing all over. So a lot of times the teams that you haven't followed as closely, you know, you're learning something new every week. With the NFL, it's home team radio. So Everything is from the point of view of the Carolina Panthers. Even our broadcast is weighted where it's 70, 75% Panthers, 25% the other team. So with the Panthers, you know, by the second preseason game, you kind of know everybody. I'm at training camp. And then with the opponents, I'll watch their last two games, usually Friday in the hotel. I'll take some notes. But it's radio, and we have two analysts in the booth. We have a sideline reporter. So for me, it's describing what happens and then adding the contextual pieces when you see fit. Sometimes there isn't room to do that. Television, it's almost in reverse.
How have you been received as the Panthers radio voice by Panthers fans? Because the connection that fans have to their local announcers is very different to that of the connection that the audience has with national announcers. And as you mentioned, you were taken over for the retiring Mick Mixon, who was there for a while before you.
And people loved Mick, and I love Mick, and Mick was wildly popular, has been a great friend and mentor to me. I would say what probably helped me was that I was not replacing Mick. I was succeeding Mick. Mick retired. Yeah. So it wasn't like, hey, we're bringing in this new guy, this mercenary from ESPN to replace our beloved guy. No, Mick was stepping down. They brought Anish in. Fans have been great. Fans have been incredible. I've interacted with them in person, at events, social media, warm and welcoming. And I think part of what has helped me, I was living in Charlotte for more than a decade before I took this job. So While I didn't grow up a Panthers fan, I've lived there long enough where I've sort of adopted them as my team. And if I had time and they were playing, I would go to a Panthers game. And usually Sunday when I would get home, Panthers were on in the background. So there was no on-ramp to the job, which was great. I've been following this team basically since they drafted Cam Newton. And then prior to that, it's not like they had this long history. They were born in 1995. That was the first year that they were playing. So it's not like you're learning 80 years of history. You know, if it was the Giants or the Steelers where you're going back pre-merger, everything was right there in front of you. And again, being in Charlotte, knowing a lot of people locally, that was huge.
Did you, were there announcers that you looked up to? I know you mentioned that you lived in Charlotte for 10 years or so, but before that you're from the Northeast. So were there specific sportscasters that you listened to that you grew up kind of wanting to emulate?
Yeah. You know, the reason I went to Syracuse was Bob Costas.
Okay.
Costas made me smarter every time I watched one of his events. He could be emceeing the opening ceremonies for the Athens Olympics. And I remember it was like this history of the Peloponnesian War and the history of ancient Greece and Thermopylae and Leonidas. Oh man, like, how does this guy know all this stuff? It was incredible. Having Marv, obviously, Ian Eagle, Len Berman used to anchor the local nightly news on NBC. I would watch Len every day. My mom loved him. Our family loved him. He was Uncle Len in our household, and we didn't have cable. We didn't have Sports Center. So we got our news from Len. And then, you know, I know they can be polarizing figures, but I can't tell you how many times in the summer I had this little pocket radio I'd go to sleep with when the Yankees were playing on the West Coast. And I would go to bed listening to John Sterling and wake up to Hannity and Combs, not knowing what I was listening to.
What about talk radio, sports talk radio?
Mike and the Mad Dog. I mean, that was coming home from school. It was Mike and the Mad Dog. It was Steve Summers. I remember the callers, Doris from Rego Park, Jerome from Manhattan.
Yep.
I lived on WFAN. I probably listened more to WFAN than I did to music when I was growing up. Yeah. That was it. It was the soundtrack in our household. We used to have this radio that went on in the bathroom. So anytime you went into the bathroom to take a shower in the morning, you turn the light switch on, the radio would go on. And it was this power struggle. My parents would keep it on 1010 Winds News. You've probably heard of it. You give us 22 minutes, we give you the world. So for me, I would time my showers at 15 and 45 because that's when you got the sports update with Steve Torrey. So radio was such a big part of our household growing up, which is kind of the neat part now of finally being able to work in radio.
Yeah, no, I'm the same way. I grew up and live on Long Island. So I grew up a WFAN diehard my entire life. It was always where, if I was in the car, I was asking to turn WFAN on. And if I was at home and had easy access to a radio, I was listening to the fan as well. What are the fans' expectations this year for the Panthers with Frank Reich and Bryce Young trading up to get the number one pick?
Listen, there is a buzz around this franchise that has not been there the last 4 or 5 years. And Bryce Young obviously has sparked it, but this coaching staff they've assembled, not just Frank Reich. You know, you brought in Dom Capers and Jim Caldwell as analysts on both sides of the ball. Deuce Staley's your running backs coach. Thomas Brown from the McVay coaching tree to be the OC. You know, a defensive coordinator who's a hot name on the head coaching market. So there is excitement. And you know, are they going to win the Super Bowl? Are they going to win 13 games? Probably not. But this division is up for grabs. And if you look at the rest of the division, Tampa's rebuilding. Atlanta, you know, sort of bottomed out in their rebuild. They're starting on their way back up. New Orleans went and got, you know, Carr to be their quarterback. Really the only established quarterback in the division. And so if Bryce Young's the real deal, the Panthers are looking at a chance here in the next 4 or 5 years while Young is on his rookie contract to seize control of this division. And you're hoping that there's a window that is about to open up where they can be a contender in the NFC.
Do you have a worst or best moment or call that you could think of from your career? And if you don't, like, don't feel like you need to dig and try to come up with some sort of answer, but just is there anything off the top of your, I'm always curious with play-by-play announcers, if there's something off the top of your head that like you kind of wish you had back, or if even if there's a moment where you're like, wow, that was a perfect call, I nailed that one.
You know what's funny, I get asked this question quite often and I never have an answer, because as play-by-play guys, and I don't know if I'm the only one, but I'm sure there's others, you're always on to the next game.
Yeah.
And there's so little time sometimes to reflect and digest what has just happened. It's on to the next game. There are moments during the course of a game where you say, oh, I thought I handled that well, or I wish I could have had a mulligan there. But I almost leave that up to whoever's watching and whoever's writing about it or whoever's consuming that. That's not for me. I'm sure there's good. I'm sure there's, you know, stuff that you can do better. But I can never come up with one every time I'm asked that.
Yeah, that's fine. I think that's probably fairly standard of play-by-play announcers, that it is on to the next one, as opposed to either celebrating or kind of dwelling over a call.
Yeah.
I know you also mentioned that you don't necessarily like to set like markers in terms of you need to be doing this by this age or this point into your career. But I would imagine you still have goals and aspirations. Like you've done a lot, but you're still young. So what is next? What are some of those goals? Would you like to call the NFL nationally? Would you like to do some sort of talk show, whether TV or radio? Maybe would you like to host Wheel of Fortune one day if it doesn't work out with Ryan Seacrest now?
I would say probably the things that are on my radar. I would love to do NBA. I would love to maybe get in the mix with Major League Baseball. And in the last few years, really since the Panthers hired me, there's been some external interest and people have reached out and saying, hey, would you be interested in doing this? And would you be interested in doing that? So that's been promising, right? That, you know, that you are being valued and people see that and see that you're capable. Probably the one thing that I would love to do at some point is write a book. And I don't necessarily know if it would be about sports. I don't necessarily know if it would be nonfiction. I love to read and I love to write. And at some point, I think I would like to sit down and write a book. The thing I struggle with that is there's not enough time, especially you got the Panthers, you got ESPN. But that has always been on my list. I just love narrative storytelling. One of the things that actually we're working on now with the Panthers, we're putting together a 8-part, maybe more, maybe less, but it's a scripted podcast series on the 2003 team, the first Panthers team to get to the Super Bowl. They lost to the Patriots in 03, the Cardiac Cats, and it's going to be scripted. We've interviewed probably more than 24 former players, plus people who covered the team, people who broadcasted their games. And it's pretty neat. We've put a lot of it together. We've put a couple of episodes together, but think sort of like 30 for 30 on a smaller scale for radio. For podcasts. So that's been fun. It's been something new that I get a chance to do. And so I am looking for things that are different, things that are new, things that unlock a different part of me, I guess.
Yeah. And you mentioned the screenplay earlier as well. have you done writing before? Like, or do you have maybe even an alias that you write under?
No, I mean, I'll say this, like I have written probably a bunch of half-written screenplays, books with an introduction and a couple of chapters, books with a middle and an ending. They're all on my laptop, and at some point I got to figure out a way to kind of put it together and find something. A lot of times what happens is in the summer where I have a little downtime, and that downtime is now less these days, I'll start a little pet project, and then football season starts. And then once football season starts, you're going a million miles per hour. You don't have time for that stuff anymore. But yeah, I'm hoping at some point, someday, I will have the time to see some of that stuff through completion.
Are you a creative person? Is that a bit of an outlet?
I think that's fair to say. I do enjoy creative risks. I do enjoy doing things differently. You're always trying to find out, why is everybody going right? Nobody's going left. And maybe sometimes the story is left or vice versa. So I enjoy the creative process. I really do. And I feel that that's the stuff that, as a play-by-player, all the curiosity going down these rabbit holes, even if it doesn't lead to anything, that's where you find the stuff that often really resonates with your viewer. You just kind of dig deep and go down these rabbit holes, and sometimes it's nothing, and sometimes, here's Wonderland. I found it, and you can unearth something. So, I enjoy the creative process quite a bit.
Great stuff. Anish, you were fantastic. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brandon.
That is Anish Shroff. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe this podcast, and I will also urge you to please subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But as always, regardless of how you consume us, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.